The north entrance to Crater Lake just opened a few days ago when crews could finally clear the snow off the entrance road. Lakes that looked desperately low in recent years are full thanks to abundant snow and rain over the winter. All the moisture also promotes the growth of fungus in the woods, and that means more mushrooms. Recent news reports show 14 people sickened in just Northern California this year from eating toxic mushrooms they picked themselves. Those are the death cap mushrooms, Amanita phalloides. And that brings up the standard set of questions. How can you tell one mushroom from another? And if you get it wrong, what happens then? Two guests who know mushrooms well join us. Dr. Michael Bug is a professor emeritus at Evergreen State College and knows mushrooms upside down, inside out. Dr. Bug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Debbie Veese is with us as well. She is with the Bay Area Mycological Society and is considered an expert on Amanita phalloides. Debbie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting.
So let's start with a really broad view, Debbie. I mean, with all the mushrooms that grow in this part of the world, is it fairly easy to make a mistake?
It depends on how willfully you ignore the data in front of you. So no one should be foraging for wild mushrooms if they don't know exactly what they're doing. And certainly, you don't want to eat any mushroom that you're not 100% sure about the identification.
And so of the mushrooms that tend to be around us in this part of the world, I mean, are the majority toxic, a minority, or is it a fairly close
Very few mushrooms are seriously toxic. The problem is the ones that are so toxic that they're probably the ones you need to learn first before you forage for any wild mushrooms.
Okay, sounds like a plan. Dr. Bug, I want to ask about your studies of mushroom poisoning, which you've been doing for nearly half a century. What has been the thrust of your research?
Well, I track mushroom poisonings throughout North America. I belong to the North American Mycological Association, and we have a group of around 160 identifiers in almost every state in the U.S. and many of the provinces of Canada. And so when there's a mushroom poisoning, those reports come into those people who help with identification and then come to me. And then I write an annual report of what mushrooms caused the poisoning and the mistakes that people probably made, in the hopes that in reading those reports, people will get better and make fewer mistakes.
Is there a fairly common, any sort of trends that we can pick out about whether this is happening more often or which mushrooms are most often responsible, any of those things?
Well, the one interesting trend that's particular to our discussion today is Amanita phalloides, which was brought over from Europe accidentally over 100 years ago, is increasing in abundance, especially on the West Coast. And since it shows up most frequently near cities and in rest areas along I-5, you know, all the way up to into Canada, more and more people are eating it because it looks delicious, and actually it tastes delicious. It'll just kill you if you don't get good treatment or if you eat too much.
Wow, that's weird to think that it tastes delicious. But Debbie Veese, how common is the Amanita phalloides, and what is it that makes it so deadly?
Well, it has these very pernicious toxins called amatoxins and phalloidins. The amatoxins bind at a cellular level and prevent protein synthesis. So basically all cell growth stops. And this happens most quickly in your gut and then in your liver, where the cells are dividing most rapidly. So that's why people tend to lose their livers if they don't get treated quickly enough for the poisonings. And what was your other question? I'm sorry.
The next one will be how common are they, and how
oh,
is it
okay.
how is
so,
they moving from place to place?
So I actually live in California, not the Pacific Northwest, and California has been where they have been behaving like an invasive species. So they first arrived here in perhaps 1938, and in just a short period of time, they have now spread everywhere across the state of California where there is live oak, including the Channel Islands off the coast, and they're switching hosts to conifer trees and different trees and oak trees. So it's a very adaptable, deadly mushroom.
So it has to move with a tree, though, it sounds like.
Well, it was brought in on the roots of trees, but then they produce spores, and those spores can travel freely to other trees, and then they get vectored by animals or what have you. So they've really been, their initial introduction was through human beings, but now they're doing it on their own, at least in California.
Okay, so we're talking about death cap mushrooms or Amanita or Amanita phylloides with Debbie Veese in the Bay Area Mycological Society and Michael Bue, Professor Emeritus at Evergreen State College, long an expert on mushroom poisoning. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions or comments may abound in your household if you're thinking about going out and foraging for mushrooms. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Michael Bue, does a wetter winter like we had, does that help the spread of these or any mushrooms?
Well, most often it's the summer that sets the fruiting in the fall, but the wetter winter certainly helps because these things need moisture. But if the trees are photosynthesizing actively, they're producing a lot of sugars, and therefore the mushrooms grow actively in association with the trees, and we will get bigger fruitings.
Is there any consistent feature, Dr. Bue, that helps people understand that a mushroom they are looking at, just sitting there on the ground, as yet unpicked, might be toxic?
Well, it's sort of like if you know how to recognize a lemon versus a lime, and you can tell the difference between the good ones and the bad ones in the Amanita group, because these are big, beautiful mushrooms, and that makes them attractive to people. But once you've carefully studied the pictures of them and carefully studied how you identify mushrooms, I think they're easy to identify. But you've got to be able to look at the top, the bottom, the sides. You can't just sort of glance at the top. You've got to study the whole mushroom to make sure you get it right. But there is no rule that's going to work. You have to know each individual mushroom.
And let me give the audience an idea of how well these two people know their mushrooms. When we put the story up on the web yesterday and provided a link back to them via email, I had put up what was identified to me as a matsutake mushroom, and they both wrote back and said, no, that's not a matsutake. It's something else. So they're both very good at this. Let's take a call. We have Chris in Eureka on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Debbie Veese and Michael Bue.
Yeah, hi. I was calling to ask about, I guess I'm a amateur mushroom enthusiast, and what I typically go for are the mushrooms that are that don't have poisonous kind of lookalikes. I know the Amanitas are in the family where, it's easy to make a mistake, and so my question specifically has to do with the Prince mushroom. They pop up, it seems like different times of the year around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, I recognize it from the almond scent, but I'd like to know if there's other lookalikes.
And that was the Prince mushroom?
That I could be concerned about. Yeah, that's a mushroom.
Okay. Thanks for that, Chris. Appreciate that. Debbie, why don't you take that one on?
All right, so the Prince is one of the agaricus species, right? You probably know this. It's the same genus as our store-bought white button mushroom. And the Prince is one of the really easier to identify agaricus species because of that odor and their big size and the beautiful scaling on the cap. But the group as a whole can be quite difficult to get to species, and there are toxic members in there, although not with an almondy odor. So if you can smell the fragrance of almonds in an agaricus, you know that it is probably a perfectly safe one to eat.
Probably perfectly. You really do want to. Are there good identification systems on the internet, for example? If you take your mushrooms home, cut them open, and look at diagrams on the internet, would that be enough?
When you're first starting out, I don't think the internet is a good way to get your information.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the mushroom societies, and these societies occur all over the country, have people that are willing to look at the mushrooms of others for free, just to help out newbies, we call them, mm-hmm. who are just starting out. And that way, somebody might be showing you one mushroom in a photo, but they might have another mushroom that's still in that bag that they didn't take out. And these are the things that keep me up at night when I'm doing identifications online. So I usually advise people not to eat a mushroom from a photo ID.
Okay, good plan. Dr. Bugo, I want to come back to you about people who have survived eating death cap mushrooms. What's the common thread? I mean, what prevented them from losing their lives, and what else did they eat, or what treatment did they get?
Well, first of all, in terms of treatment, the critical thing is to get to the hospital as soon as you know you've been poisoned and get on IV intravenous fluids. And because anytime you've got vomiting and diarrhea, fluid loss is going to cause damage to your kidneys, whether it was a deadly mushroom you ate or not. And so that's the number one rule, is getting good, aggressive intravenous fluids as quickly as possible. And when somebody has consumed Amanita phalloides, that alone will save 80 to 90% of the individuals. The second thing is if you haven't eaten a huge amount, your chances of survival are way better than if you make a big meal of a mushroom you don't know.
Okay, and I understand there's something called the Santa Cruz Protocol for dealing with some of these cases?
Yes, and the key to the Santa Cruz Protocol is to start with the IV fluids, and a lot of IV fluids. And this is the thing that most doctors underestimate, is the importance of the intravenous fluids. And then you monitor the liver enzymes, because as Debbie mentioned, amatoxins bind to RNA polymerase, and they literally shut down protein synthesis, and then you see a change in liver enzyme levels just spike as a result of the damage to the liver. So when you see that spike, you know you're in a real potential trouble. And there are guidelines: when it gets so high, then you want to add some additional treatments. If the blood is getting thin as a result of coagulation factors no longer being produced, then you've got to add vitamin K. And if the levels get really high of the liver enzymes, you want to have intravenous psilocybin, which is a extract of milk thistle that's been purified and treated in a way that makes it safely injectable. And with that combination of treatment, you can save about 95% of people. But in some cases, a liver transplant may be required.
I noticed there are several years of clinical trials now on the psilocybin remedy for the damage. But there are some practical and ethical obstacles, I understand, in trying out the remedy.
Well, because it's an experimental technique, you have to go through the Dr. Todd Mitchell's website, and doctors should know how to do this and get approval and follow that regimen very strictly, and that'll give you a high percentage of survival.
And I understand, too, that a pharmaceutical company with a PR problem bought the rights to the brand name drug.
Yeah, it's the same pharmaceutical company that makes the EpiPen and has driven up the cost of the EpiPen exorbitantly. And there's great fear that they're going to do the same thing with the injectable psilocybin and make it exorbitantly expensive for people to obtain.
Debbie Veese, I haven't asked yet about whether there are any mushrooms that are toxic raw, but you can cook the toxicity out of them.
Yes, there's actually quite a few. In fact, we advise most people cook all their mushrooms, and we include the store-bought mushrooms in that recommendation. So they have various components in them that sometimes are carcinogenic, hydrazines that get driven off by cooking. And then mushrooms are just not that digestible raw, so it's really best to cook them.
Even the ones you throw in a salad, you're saying?
Yeah, don't throw them in the salad would be my recommendation. Throw them out of the salad.
Is that a scientific or a gourmet recommendation?
Well, all of the above.
Okay. I haven't asked about non-humans. I mean, Debbie, are death cap and the others just as toxic to other animals?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. It seems that there are some differences between animals, but we know for a fact that it kills dogs, and it kills them on a regular basis in California.
All right, Michael Bugh, we got a question here from Jamie in Medford who dropped it off. He wants to know if there are any poisonous lookalikes to morel mushrooms.
I hesitate to answer that because it really depends on whether you can tell a lemon from a lime from an apple. I think morels are incredibly distinctive. But I have held up a Gyromatra esculenta, which is shaped like a brain and is reddish brown in color, and a morel, which looks like a sponge and is kind of grayish black in color, and showed it one in each hand to this person. She said, she looked at him and said, I can't tell the difference.
Wow.
You know, and it's sort of, to me, one looked like a watermelon and the other looked like an apple. You know, they're what I call 55-mile-an-hour mushrooms. I can actually identify a morel at up to 35 miles just an hour glancing out the side window of my car. And morels are probably the most popular edible. And by the way, they are quite poisonous raw.
Oh, wow. Okay, good to know. Here's a final question from Jeff in Medford. Very little time left with Debbie Veese and Michael Bugh.
Good morning. First of all, I'm wondering if a lobster mushroom could ever be poisonous, if that lichen or fungus or whatever grows on the lobster mushroom can grow on a poisonous mushroom. And also, the Amanita seems like the people that probably get poisoned are getting poisoned by the very tiny button stage, you know, because maybe that button is hard to distinguish from an agaricus. Or,
all right, let's get an answer because we just got less than a minute left here. Mike, you
want
to
take... Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah. Lobster mushrooms?
Lobster mushrooms theoretically can grow on a wide range of different species, but in my experience, they only grow on one species of Russula. They are edible to almost everyone, but there are always people that will react to things that are edible to most people. You know, like peanuts will kill some people.
Okay, so yeah, as we've heard, just be 100% sure. Great advice from Debbie Veese of the Bay Area Mycological Society and Michael Bugh, Professor Emeritus at Evergreen State College. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.